first off, you know, having a producer suggest something to us was taboo. It's like, you know, shut your face, you know, forget it. We're doing it our way.
It was a very pragmatic approach.
But we were just afraid of trying, you know, other people's ideas. And that, you know, this is our band and don't tell us what to do. And that's how we got where we were at that point, and it worked.
Never free, never me. So I dump the unforgiven.
If you listen to the grooves that are on Injustice for All and you put them up against the grooves that are on the Black Album just feels better, you know? It rocks more, it's just a lot more soulful.
Never care for what they know.
Hey friends, this is James from Metallica.
Yo, this is Kirk of Metallica in the studio for the Black Album.
Since its August 1991 release, Metallica's self-titled album, affectionately known as the Black Album, has sold a staggering 22 million copies worldwide. Now, to put that in some kind of historical context for you, that's several million more than either Sgt. Pepper or Abbey Road by the Beatles or any Led Zeppelin album. Metallica's Black Album is in a direct family tree of hard rock, heavy metal, musical evolution that you can trace from 1969-1970. Like AC/DC's Back in Black a decade before it, Metallica's Black Album is the hard rock collection for people who don't even like hard rock. Both similarly sleeved in solid black covers, they each ironically came immediately after the tragic accidental death of a band member, only to become each band's biggest selling album of their career. Here's Metallica's lead guitarist, Kirk Hammett, and guitarist, lyricist, singer, James Hetfield, in the studio, talking about the Black Album's phenomenal success.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that our music is very, very mature sounding and very responsible sounding, and it isn't based on a lot of like cartoonish kind of images that a lot of heavy metal bands did have at the time also. And a lot of people picked up on that, and it got to the point, like, as James was saying, you know, that the demand for us just increased. And I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, you know, you could take us seriously. We weren't just cartoon characters, you know, heavy metal cartoon characters.
Yeah, there wasn't the Satan, you know, references and the spikes and all the, just kind of the comedy of it all.
Sex, drugs, rock and roll kind of stuff.
This was more honesty. This was us, you know, musicians playing the style of music that we felt from the heart. It's a combination of honesty, selfishness, and therapy for us, all this is, really.
Yeah, sincerity, too. We're very sincere.
There's a lot of people out there that believed that we knew what we were doing. And
we fooled them all.
But it was great that we had a carte blanche. We could kind of do what we wanted. There wasn't a record guy, you know, record company guy sitting in the studio, you know, say on the Black record, sitting there going, I'm not sure about that song. Why don't you try this and all that? It's like, we never, ever had that.
Yeah, and you know, we don't know any other way now. We're not used to, you know, other bands coming in and saying, yeah, well, you know, the record company person was in the studio telling us what to play. And when I hear that, I'm just like totally blown away.
The first tremors for Metallica emanated from the Los Angeles suburbs when guitarist-singer James Hetfield, a trucking company owner's son raised in a strict Christian Science household, met world-traveled drummer Lars Ulrich, son of Danish tennis pro Torben Ulrich. But to land their second bass player, Cliff Burton, Metallica had to relocate to Burton's San Francisco Bay Area home, where lead guitarist Kirk Hammett was soon to join there too. Uncompromising hard rock, hard work, and the payphone across from the Burger King all helped Metallica eventually get signed to Q Prime managers Peter Mensch and Cliff Bernstein, who got Metallica the opening slot on a 1986 Ozzy Osbourne tour. Metallica lead guitarist Kirk Hammett remembers that was the heavy metal baptism by fire.
Professionalism on a completely different level, you know. It was also really, really great to be out on a supporting arena tour.
Why?
Because we were young, you know, we had something to prove, and we had accessibility to the audience, you know, that we wanted to reach. And it was more attitude of just going out there and just conquering as many people as we could with our shows. A really go for the throat type of attitude. And we just went out there and just played our butts off. And it was also great opening up for Ozzy, because he was such a huge inspiration, you know, him coming from Sabbath. And yeah. Cliff was in heaven the entire time. Cliff would just constantly talk about how great it was and how great of a time he was having.
Yeah, Ozzy was a hero for us all, really.
Yeah, definitely.
And just to see how other outfits ran on the road, and wow, Ozzy's got a personal guy, and
Yeah.
And you can't drink in the hallways because Ozzy, you know, this and that. It's like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the other side of it all. You can go too far with some of this. But truly, there were a lot of fans out there that had never been exposed to something a little heavier or a little more hardcore than, you know, your Sabbath or Ozzy. And we gained quite a few fans on that. And I learned a lot of, I guess, a little more performance, you know. There was, you know, we'd just go out, bang our heads, and play as fast as possible. But then I learned, well, you know, you got to talk between these songs. You have to, you know, there's a performance part to this, you know. And it really, you know, I would not look great in a long, sparkly coat like Ozzy, but, you know, there was some showmanship to it all. And that you know, the more you practice something, the more you're on the road, the better you get at it. And we definitely became the road dogs at that point. The other thing was power. I think that all the power that you had really had on stage, and the control, because in it was Long Beach Arena where the fans started to rip up all the seats.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
They just started tearing the seats up and throwing them. And, you know, a lot of our fans would come to these arenas and think they're still in a club and can trash the place, you know. So they're tearing stuff up and, you know, they're ruining this arena. And at that point, it was like, wow, I need to step up to the plate here and, you know, tell them what's going down here. It's like, stop. This is, you know, it was kind of the first time I had to tell the crowd to stop doing something.
Stop,
you know? It was always, come on, do something. And now it was, whoa, this has gone a little too far. And, you know, we have to pay for these seats. That was the main bit.
Metallica used the momentum from the Ozzy Osbourne tour to headline theaters in Europe and Scandinavia. In September 1986, while traveling between gigs in Sweden, a freak accident would alter the course of Metallica forever.
It's, you know, it's just one of those things you will never really learn the entire truth, you know, because basically we were all asleep when it happened. Really? Everyone was asleep. And, you know, who knows, maybe the driver is asleep too. But the driver hit a patch of ice. The bus went skidding and toppled over.
Are we talking about a regular coach kind of bus that buses do in America?
A European tour bus.
Well, that was the problem, because the tour buses you see here, the coaches, you know, they're all metal siding. And over there, they don't have those. They're regular, like, touring, you know, tourists with cameras and windows and things. Oh. So it was converted to bunks. So it was all windows on the sides. And that was the main cause of the death, I believe. But, it was like 5 in the morning, you know, 20 below in Sweden in the wintertime. And it was partway through the tour, my throat was going bad, so I couldn't sleep near these windows. It was, you know, the cold was getting to me, so I was sleeping in the back lounge of the bus, and I was actually up on the same level and same side as Cliff, and I was, you know, my luggage was there instead. But yeah, it hit so-called black ice, you know, and skidded out. It bounced once, and then that's when he went through the window and the bus went right on him. So it was pretty quick, and I know he didn't know what hit him. But you know, just coming out and finding your buddy under the bus is not something you want to go through.
Yeah, this is a horrible thing, truly horrible, and one of the worst things that's ever happened, really.
But, you know, the initial reaction was complete anger. You know, that's what we were good at, you know, seeing that and what, why, you know, how did this happen? Why, you know, where's the driver? And, you know,
he's freaking out.
He's freaking going, well, I hit some ice and, you know, let me smell your breath, all of this. And I walked for miles looking for this black ice, you know, in my underwear, and, you know, 20 below. There were some screams from the crew, you know, that were still trapped in there, you know, just screaming in pain. A couple other people injured themselves, broken collarbones, toes, things like that. But, you know, the passing of Cliff was just beyond belief. Sitting there in the hospital, all of us in shock.
You know, total just, shock.
Influenced musically by Clint Eastwood spaghetti western composer Ennio Morricone, that's Metallica's The Unforgiven from the Black Album. Coming next, Metallica's James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett reveal the depths of their despair from the tragic death of bass player Cliff Burton and how they coped. Be sure to follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear more Rockstar interviews, lots more, at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett for Metallica's anniversary of The Black Album.
Hey friends, this is James from Metallica.
Yo, this is Kirk of Metallica.
And you're in the studio for The Black Album.
I'm Redbeard. With bass player Cliff Burton's death in the tour bus accident, Metallica's surviving band members were disbelieving, devastated, and thousands of miles from home. First, James Hetfield.
Jumping right into the bottle, you know, that was how we handled that, I recall.
Yeah.
You and I getting ripped out of our heads, and that definitely didn't help.
Just having to make that call, you know, to all our friends and family back home was just difficult because it felt like, you know, you're reliving it all over again. Right. And it was just, it was just so fresh in our minds that, you know, I know that for at least the first 24 hours, I was in total just disbelief, you know. Sure. I could not believe that it happened. It didn't happen. For a while, I didn't think it happened, you know. I tried to, like, just block it out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, once we got home, we had to, like, deal with it all and deal with, you know, that sense of loss and his funeral. And it was just really, really hard. And in retrospect, I think we just kind of really didn't give ourselves enough time really to just recover from the grief. You know, we kind of sat around and just tried to get our heads together for a couple of weeks, and then we regrouped and decided, you know, what we should do.
It was Peter that came out. Peter Mensch came out and that next day and just sat us all down and just said, you know what, you've got to battle on, you've got to play this through, you know, through your music, get it out, get your therapy out through your music, and keep, you know, jump right back on the horse and keep riding, you know.
Yeah.
And we couldn't believe that this guy was telling us this, you know. What do you mean, man? This is our buddy, and screw you. And, you know, it took us a few days to kind of grasp the concept of that kind of strength. And Cliff's, you know, wishes, I'm sure, were to battle on, friends, you know.
Yeah, that was kind of the perspective we took, is that, you know, if Cliff was alive, he'd want us to continue, because that was the type of person he was, you know. He was a very driven person.
Really?
You know, very, very driven. We took the perspective that, he wouldn't want to see us lose that drive that he was a part of. And so decided that Cliff would want us to carry on.
Dream.
dream, mindless tray. I'm your eyes while you're away. I'm your pain while you repay. You know what said the
Sad But True comes from Metallica's Black Album. As far as auditions for a new bass player, many were called, but only one, Jason Newsted, was chosen. It took several albums before Metallica even considered an outside producer. The guys at Metallica noticed the name of producer Bob Rock on albums that they admired. Here's James and Kirk of Metallica.
The Cult was one.
The Cult who we toured with on the Injustice for All tour.
Right.
Sonic Temple.
The sounds that he would pull out of them, and at that point we really knew we needed some direction. The Justice for All album was Lars and me playing producers at that point, you know. You put the record on and what's loud? Guitar and drums and some vocals. There's no bass, there's no nothing else, you know.
It became
too far, and we realized that later, like, wow. And then when we toured with the album, the songs were so long and extravagant and complex that the crowd would just kind of go into a daze, you know, try and get as many riffs into the song as possible. And on the Black record was quite the opposite. Let's take one good riff and just go with it. Fill holes, let other people show off with solos. You know, you take it for a little while. And so we learned a little bit about that on that tour. You know, we need some shorter songs with some muscle. Bob was good at that, really.
Yeah.
What? It was a little intimidation on both sides. You know, he was a little intimidated coming in saying, these guys have never had a producer and, you know, I've heard they're mean and their songs are angry and this and that. And, boy, I don't really want to tell them what to do. And, boy, should I suggest this? He would keep things back, you know.
Can you blame him?
No. But we didn't help him too much. We were, he called me Dr. No, because everything was, you know, he'd say, well, how about this? No. You know, it's not, you know, as soon as he'd open his mouth, no would come out of mine, you know. I still had some blinders on, and I, you know, we got to do it this way, you know. And I was, that came with probably a little, I guess, inconfidence in myself, you know. So I think now we're a little more open to, we'll take in a suggestion and then. Then say no. Yeah. At least contemplate it.
Bob had this term after working with us for like 2 or 3 months in the studio. He had this term called the Metallic Brow, which was every time, you know, he'd ask us a question, all four of us would start frowning, and he'd say, "Uh-oh, Metallic Brow." I'm getting the Metallic Brow again. Yeah. You know, he'd suggest something, you know, in like, you know, a solo or something, and I'd just sit there and start frowning, and he'd say, "Oh, Metallic Brow, he's thinking." It's kind of funny after a while. But yeah, there was a lot of headbutting, and there's a lot of tension. And, you know, the farther along the album got, the more the tension kind of just, like, built up. At the end of the day, if that's what we had to do to get this album out, you know, that's what we had to do.
There's always been tension on all the records, and tension and competition and all that is good.
Yeah.
This is great
definitely.
For us.
It's healthy.
Yeah. It was just another guy in there, in the mix.
Yeah.
A new victim.
Still to come, James Hetfield reveals the critical song he composed which pointed the way to the summit for the Black Album. I'm Redbeard in the studio with James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett for the anniversary of Metallica's Black Album.
Yo, this is Kirk of Metallica in the studio.
Hey friends, this is James from Metallica, and you're in the studio
for the Black Album.
Ranked number 252 on Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time, and the number 8 seller for the entire 90s decade. I'm Redbeard. Two earlier Metallica songs, Fade to Black and One, were musical signposts from James Hetfield. You see, prior to 1991's Black Album, Metallica was a cult band known for thrash speed metal. The change in sound did draw a few complaints from hardcore early fans. Here's James Hetfield.
We've heard sellout since, you know, you mentioned Fade to Black. That was our sellout, you know. Oh, they've sold out completely, you know. They did a
something
a
with melody.
Oh,
yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, with
we've heard that every album, and people, you know. A lot of people do understand that, you know, that doesn't mean sellout. Sellout means you're actually writing a song for somebody else. You're conforming to what they need. And really, we do respect and take care of our fans, and they do likewise. There's a mutual respect. We've got plenty of things set up, you know, fan clubs and meet and greets and things where we actually treat them as humans and they do us. You know, it's not we're on a pedestal or they are, you know, we're level there. As a lyricist, it was a little more difficult. You know, I had, 12 songs, you know, separate, you know, you got to try to give these separate identities here. And so it was a little more of a challenge. But a lot of these had been around quite a while, like Sad But True, Nothing Else Matters was something that I had written on the road on the Justice Tour that was just, it was for myself on a little, you know, four track and kind of me alone in my room doing a song for myself, and that got heard by a certain Lars Ulrich, and I didn't think it was Metallica. I didn't think it would, you know, belong with us, but he saw something in that song that was it was different, it was unique, it was complete honesty to it, you know, kind of an unveiling of, you know, big machismo, you know. And so I added quite a new dimension to us at that point. You know, we had done ballads before, like you mentioned, Fade to Black and One, but this was one that was really, you know, a little more personable, and maybe possibly a little more universal in feeling.
So close, no matter how far, couldn't be much more from the heart, forever trusting who we are, and nothing else matters. Myself this way, life is ours, we live it our way. Hold these words I don't just say, and nothing else matters. Trust I seek and I find in you. Every day for us something new. Open mind for a different view, and nothing else matters. Never care for what they do, never care for what they know, but I know so close.
myself this way. Life is ours, we live it our way. Hold these words, I don't just say, and nothing else matters. Trust I seek, and I find in you. Every day for us something new. Open my
Else Matters is the best example of how Metallica successfully relinquished the producer's reins, concluding that the limitations of their previous albums had been all self-imposed, according to Metallica's lead singer, James Hetfield.
I mean, first off, you know, having a producer suggest something to us was taboo. It's like, you know, shut your face, you know, forget it. We're doing it our way.
It was a very pragmatic approach.
But we were just afraid of trying, you know, other people's ideas. And that, you know, this is our band and don't tell us what to do. And that's how we got where we were at that point, and it worked. So we wanted to break some new ground. We wanted to try some new things. And, you know, Nothing Else Matters, I keep referring to, but that was the one, you know, orchestration on, you know, Nothing Else Matters, arranged by Michael Kamen. You know, I'd always loved Brian May and the way he would, you know, get orchestra sounds on his guitars, you know, like three-part harmonies moving and all this. Just, you know, he was awesome at that. You know, he could sit there and,
incredible.
You know, he could direct a symphony, I think. But that was what I was kind of going for on Nothing Else Matters. I had the Ebo on the guitar and was doing all these harmony things, and it sounded cool. But Bob and I sat down and said, well, why don't we just, you know, get a real orchestra to do all this stuff? And, oh, yeah, why don't we try that, you know? And I could not picture us sitting there with this orchestra, you know, oh, my God. So we basically packed up the tape, sent it off to this guy who had done, he had done some stuff on Queensryche, you know, Silent Lucidity and things. So, you know, they were on Q Prime as well. So there was a connection. We really sent the tape away with instructions, you know, don't mess with guitar parts, you know, all this stuff, you know. And it's like, you can't give, you know, instructions to this guy.
We know where you live.
The traditional gatekeepers and kingmakers of rock respectability and success, that being radio, Rolling Stone magazine, the Grammy Awards, and MTV, all thought that by ignoring heavy metal, it would just go away. That conspiracy lasted a full 20 years. I asked James and Kirk of Metallica why heavy metal did not end with the first four Black Sabbath albums, for instance.
Conspiracy like that.
Yeah, really, because that's pretty spot on. It's the energy, you know, I think. It resonates within a lot of people, heavy metal or heavy aggressive music. People hear it and can instantly relate because it strikes a chord within them that they can, you know, just relate to. It's the energy, it's the aggression, and a lot of people have, you know, points in their lives where hearing energy and aggression in music really, really makes them feel better and makes them forget about all the daily crap that they have to deal with. It takes them away in a way they want to be taken away.
Lead guitarist Kirk Hammett attributes the remarkable improvement in Metallica's recorded sound on the Black Album to a shift in approach.
And, you know, I think that that's the album where we started playing with the attitude of, like, you know, like establishing a groove and playing off the groove in a really kind of bluesy, greasy way. And, you know, just kind of like helping the groove along, you know, whatever way you could do it with, like, guitar fills or you know, vocal fills or you know, certain melodies here or there. But if you listen to the grooves that are on Injustice for All and you put them up against the grooves that are on the Black Album just feels better, you know. It rocks more. It's just a lot more soulful.
We'll be right back. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, James Hetfield and Kirk Hammett. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter and online at inthestudio.net.